You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A, and this issue covers 2 months, December 2025 and January 2026. Here's the continuation of California Schemin' by Lachlan Cartwright. While New York is a community where Adams and Bill de Blasio are household names, Los Angeles is a series of neighborhoods that don't talk to each other and don't pay as much attention to local politics. That different paradigm may be a stumbling block for the California Post. If residents struggle to even know the names of their city council members or the contenders to replace Newsom as governor, will the puns still be fun? I think the opportunity to have more voices heard, I support that, Soon Shung tells me. I don't think there should be a reason there should be a single voice. I welcome the opportunity for anybody to have their voice heard in California. For Murdoch, who has property in California and loves newspapers, bringing his beloved New York Post to the state has been years in the making. With his vineyard nestled in the Santa Monica Mountains, he is watching the project closely. Even at 94, he still has newspaper ink pumping through his veins. He is very excited about the product and what we are doing, Poole tells me. He obviously knows L.A. and California and the areas and the processes and the issues very well. It's been very good to get an education about some of how things work and the history of the place. But I think similarly, Lachlan and Rupert are extremely supportive and very much looking forward to a New York Post-type product in the California market. Poole and Paps are aiming to be disruptors in California, breaking big yarns that make noise. But first, they need a quintessential Hollywood executive mode of transportation. We are trying to see if the budget can stretch to a California Post golf cart, Poole tells me. We don't feel like we've arrived in L.A. unless we've got a golf cart to get around the lot. How to Win an Oscar, or Go Broke Trying. Awards season, an annual circus of consultants and events, is awash in money. Nearly everyone involved seems to tolerate this at best. So why does Hollywood keep doing it? Joy Press looks for answers. A crowd swarms outside the Grand Hotel Excelsior, stretching all the way down to the Palazzo del Cinema, where Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein is about to have its world premiere at the Venice Film Festival. Inside the hotel, del Toro sits on a low chair, engulfed by well-wishers who place drinks in front of him like sacred offerings. Hours later, after the movie has screened, receiving a standing ovation that lasts more than 13 minutes, I spot the filmmaker once again. Leaning heavily on a cane, del Toro makes his way up the dock, where a water taxi will whisk him away as festival attendees cheer. Later that night, I overhear someone say, "Frankenstein has officially entered the awards chat." That's one of the very reasons studios send their movies to Venice, where a single ride on a private water taxi can cost as much as a meal at Le Bernardin. It's the quickest way to put your movie on the radar of Academy Awards voters. Frankenstein was just one of Netflix's Oscar hopes to premiere there in 2025, along with Noah Baumbach's Jay Kelly and Catherine Bigelow's A House of Dynamite. But other streamers and studios were just as eager to join. New movies from auteurs Yorgos Lanthimos, Luca Guadagnino, and Park Chan-wook also launched there this year, and superstars like Julia Roberts, Jude Law, Colman Domingo, and Cate Blanchett all walked the red carpet. Festivals like Venice are a highly effective way of reaching the Oscar electorate, given that just over 20% of Academy members are now located outside the United States. So studios seeking gold statuettes send their contenders on a grueling marathon of global film festivals. After the floating city, there's Toronto, Sao Paulo, and Stockholm. "You feel like a bit of a hustler," the director of an Oscar-winning film tells me. "You feel weirdly exposed doing constant interviews and events where you were trying to galvanize people behind the project." He speaks longingly of the early days of the Academy Awards, when you just showed up on the night and had a few martinis. But it's evolved into this huge Oscar industrial complex. It's mind-boggling and a little soul-destroying. For an actor like Channing Tatum, it's also nightmare fodder. He describes the Cannes Film Festival as entering the Colosseum with your art piece. "It's like a gladiator going in, and you can die." Awards strategists act as unofficial tour guides through this prestige circus, helping studios plan complex campaigns, covertly shape the media narrative about a movie, and usher talent through the awards season gauntlet. Harvey Weinstein weaponized For Your Consideration campaigns back in the 1990s at Miramax, which became a training ground for many of today's awards gurus. In 2025, as the movie industry struggles, the quest for Oscars has only intensified. So has the price tag, inspiring one of Hollywood's favorite guessing games. Did one studio really spend $60 million on awards hype for a single film in a recent season, as some competitors have whispered? There's no transparency, because the first rule of awards campaigning is do not talk about awards campaigning. Occasionally someone says it out loud, though, like Neon's Tom Quinn, who owned up to forking out $18 million on the marketing, distribution, and awards campaign for last year's Oscar winner, Anora, triple the budget of the actual movie. That was after the distributor spent what was said to be $20 million on Neon's first Best Picture winner, Parasite. I'm told $20 million is a pretty standard awards budget for major studios these days, though indies can make do with far less. Rarely does anyone want to admit throwing wads of money at a prize, but campaign expenses might include buying an ad on the front cover of a trade magazine like Variety, as A Star Is Born did, throwing an elaborate Victorian-style fair complete with hot air balloons, as Amazon did for the Aeronauts, sending select voters signed sheet music for Billie Eilish's theme song from MGM's James Bond movie No Time to Die, or flying in the cast to surprise guests at a New York screening, as Warner Brothers did for One Battle After Another. Last year, days before the final Academy Awards voting deadline, Oscar nominees Bradley Cooper and Carey Mulligan even appeared at a Lincoln Center program, during which Cooper's conducting teacher for Maestro led members of the New York Philharmonic through music from the film. In the photo, Cash for Gold, at the 2025 Vanity Fair Oscar party, Zoe Saldana's statuette was ready for its close-up, following a long, exhausting, and extraordinarily expensive campaign. Streamers helped push up budgets in recent years. They need to differentiate themselves, and also they need to get high-caliber talent to come to the studio, says One Awards Space publicist, who's worked for both streamers and traditional studios. But the idea that spending the most money will nab votes, well, that just results in the world's biggest eye roll. If you could buy a Best Picture Oscar, Netflix would have won, the publicist continues. The streamer has come close, with a Best Picture nominee every year since 2018, but so far the big prize has eluded it, despite substantial awards budgets. The one thing that we've truly learned over the years is that you cannot tell people how to vote, no matter how much money you spend. In fact, says veteran awards strategist Tony Angelotti, I'm confident on a number of occasions regarding previous nominees and wins, the team I worked for spent less than the competition. But like other strategists I speak to, he describes a bespoke process that's different for every movie. When you have a film on a roll, the budget necessarily expands because the campaign beast needs to be fed by event participations, more advertising, more screenings, etc. The range is all over the place, depending upon the pockets of the distributor. It can be like trying to pin a tail on a donkey blindfolded, figuring out what a budget might be early on. A massive vibe shift occurred in recent years as the Academy's post-hashtag OscarSoWhite push for a more diverse membership led to a voting body spread across the globe. It's as if Parasite opened the floodgates and the whole world rushed in. Instead of American studios competing only with one another for recognition, they are now sparring with all of international cinema. The Academy once was around 6,000 people. Now we're close to 11,000, says publicist Leah Yardum, who's worked with Best Picture winners including Parasite and Anora. They have different points of views. They speak different languages. So there are a lot of logistics that you have to conquer in the course of doing your day-to-day job. Rather than bringing the director and stars of a film to Los Angeles for 2 months, for instance, strategists now may send them off to far-flung locations to kiss babies and befriend local cinephiles. It's like Groundhog Day, says Maria Clemente, co-founder of award strategy agency Take Two. You're doing the same thing over and over again, one day after another, but in different cities with different audiences. Her business partner, Antonio Jimenez Palazón, compares it to a political campaign. You cannot just get away with just a big convention. You have to do grassroots and go where the voters are. By one estimate from Oscar pundit Steve Pond, it could take fewer than 1,000 top votes to guarantee a Best Picture nomination, and just over 200 for Best Actor, so it's worthwhile to leave no vote unturned. Jimenez Palazón says turnout is generally stronger and more fervent in international cities than Los Angeles, where jaded industry insiders get bombarded by invitations to events. And when an overseas film or actor is nominated, it becomes a matter of national pride. The Oscars, it's like a gold medal in the Olympics, he says, remembering mass celebrations in the streets of Brazil when I'm still here won last year. One high-profile strategist was pleasantly surprised by recent screenings in Europe. I was like, oh, this is different here. They don't go all out on the food and drinks like they do in the U.S. These people actually come to watch a movie. It's a far cry from one American event where an Academy member approached her. He pointed his finger in my face and complained, "You're not serving food at your screenings." I stood there for a moment, and then I said, "Why would I serve food when everyone in that movie dies? You should really get in your car and think about what happened in that movie." In the nonfiction scene, creative thinking was already essential. "We don't have the budgets, so we have to be frugal and nimble," says Suncatcher Productions founder Annalisa Shoemaker, who distributed the Oscar-nominated documentary feature To Kill a Tiger. Dev Patel and Mindy Kaling came on board as executive producers, using their platforms to promote the project. Having previously worked at Focus Features and Amazon Studios, Shoemaker says, "I was from the studio mindset of lots of money is what you need. This experience really made me rethink it. What really matters here? What are we doing?" The Academy has attempted to reform the campaign process over the years to rein in the feeding frenzy. The current rules forbid sit-down meals at screenings and the serving of any free food or beverage after nominations have been announced. It also bans disparaging social media posts. Nearly everyone I spoke to believed that dirty tricks, negative narratives that suddenly materialize at a key point in the Oscars race, assumed to be planted by a competing strategist, have waned. Still, it's hard to know if smears or self-owns were at work last year. With the timely resurfacing of Emilia Perez star Carla Sofia Gascon's offensive social media post and the late-breaking revelation of an AI speech tool being used in The Brutalist. Despite these potential landmines, awards season remains central to Hollywood, even more important than ever in this unstable moment. That's especially true for the talent. Getting the cachet of winning an Oscar helps in negotiating new deals and just global recognition, says one longtime awards consultant. Hence, all those actors and directors trooping through an endless succession of festivals, screenings, talk shows, online interviews, and meet and greets. I've been in situations where actors have really just committed to the campaign and appeared in everything, and it's had a definite effect, says the film director. If you don't go full bore into the awards circus and then you lose, you'll never know if you could have squeaked out a nomination with a little charm offensive. Just ask two-time Oscar winner Sean Penn, who is a potential contender again this year for his role in Paul Thomas Anderson's One Battle After Another. Social discomfort made him averse to participating in the awards race for many years, but when Mystic River was nominated in 2004, he felt he needed to support the film. "If you didn't go, you thought you'd be letting everyone down," he says. "You saved some Percocet or something to get through a night, and then if you win, there's only one sensation you feel. It's relief. It's over." Additional reporting for this article by Rebecca Ford. Thank you. all in vain. Vera Papasova spends the day with Hollywood's new in-demand accoutrement, a blood concierge. Opening photo shows an old-looking painting with what looks like a bloodletting occurring as a serpent bites a young girl's arm. Blood Money, Nico Argento supplies a comprehensive a la carte menu of bespoke blood treatments, ranging from hormones like estrogen and platelet-rich plasma to vitamin infusions. Nico Argento believes it's what's on the inside that counts. He believes this because he is in the business of curating bespoke immortality for the chronically rich and famous. His conviction has made him a quiet legend among the beautiful and the damned. It's not so much that he wants your blood, but that his very particular skills permit him to avoid the black market and get you anything you need whenever you need it. Exotic peptides, a private nurse to inject them, salmon DNA, and a regenerative substance banned across all mainstream professional sports. And among the novelties and oddities available via his concierge services is his treatment to perfect and enhance what flows within your veins. Death may be inevitable, but decay is optional. For approximately $250,000 a year, Argento, the founder of Members Only Health, will customize your blood. Many experts call the treatments risky. The challenge appeals to Argento, who says he's not advocating for anything bad. We find the yes behind the no, he says, and we hardly say that can't happen. He comes recommended by everyone who's anyone, not just in Hollywood, but in Silicon Valley, on Wall Street, and on the private jets, royal courts, and yachts off Monaco, where masters of the universe drift. His name is like a password for a secret club that understands appearances are everything, only up to the point at which you have everything you want. Beyond material desires is the desire to transcend our mortality. This is reflected through pedestrian habits and procedures from biohacking to Botox. It's the anxiety that hums behind anti-aging and pro-longevity protocols. What seems just superficial or narcissistic is a primal scream of the profound human fear that accompanies our uncertainty about our circumstances. That Argento has mastered the unseen realms of our blood affords him special status in the world of concierge wellness advisors and elite fixers. When I call Argento, he's in Paris. One of his clients is there on tour and in urgent need of stem cells as a pick-me-up. For stem cells, exosomes, peptides, IV infusions, and even certain facials, his team handles everything in-house. If a client requests something exotic or unavailable, Argento will make the introduction to the right expert. What he can't do himself, he will make happen. A majority of high-net-worth celebrity entertainment industry clientele are doing these treatments to stay healthy and in front of the game, Argento says. He speaks slowly and chooses his words carefully. This is his first time agreeing to an interview. Even though his company is described as a regenerative medicine concierge, he prefers to describe himself as a fixer, because he's the guy people usually call when there's a problem with their blood, their treatments, or their health plan. That's why he and his team insist on comprehensive screenings and biomarker tracking, as well as reviewing each client's blood panel line by line. Whether it's purely for vanity or to repair an old injury, celebrities are re-engineering their blood with testosterone, estrogen, and progesterone swirling alongside human growth hormone and GLP-1. Peptides like BPC-157 are injected as casually as espresso shots, while NAD fills IV bags with the promise of a youthful glow. Add to that the micronized stem cells, exosomes, vitamin infusions, platelet-rich plasma, nootropics, and adaptogens, a custom-made recipe of biology and branding, equal parts science experiment and status symbol. What could go wrong? The approach has shifted because people have realized that you can make someone really sick really quickly if you don't guide them, Argento admits. I've had clients who never did pre-cancer diagnostics before they started treatment, and within 2 months, the cancer grew from like stage 1 or stage 0 to like stage 3, Argento explains. They went on these peptides and had no idea that it could do this, because unfortunately, whoever sold it to them or gave it to them never disclosed any of that. His team isn't the only one dealing with uninformed decisions made by impatient people getting treatments from an entire ecosystem of luxury performance clinics and longevity spas whose upselling is flooding red carpet bloodstreams with overpriced cocktails that may be counterproductive. In Venice Beach, Brian Johnson famously hosts Don't Die dinners for high-profile friends. He discusses mortality and human advancement. He also offers to help guests with their blood work. Johnson is arguably the most measured man in human history and has tried and documented every popular and experimental longevity treatment while sharing his results publicly. He has said he spends $2 million annually on slow aging and recently started his own religion. Many celebrities look to him as a sort of consultant for their own routines. And, surprisingly, he's completely against the whole lifestyle. Most people do these therapies for the psychological benefit, Johnson tells me after I ask him if anything actually works. The stance is almost shocking, considering the money and time he has spent making headlines for stunts like infusing his teenage son's blood into his own. They want to feel like they're offsetting the bad things they do for their health, he says, with the scientific tone of someone who's tried and calculated it all. Then he pivots. The reality is that a lot of these therapies have inconclusive evidence, and some may actually be dangerous. He sounds less like a biohacker mogul and more like a dad warning kids about marijuana. You pair that with the fact that they are not measuring the effects of these therapies, so you don't even know if it's doing good or bad in your body. According to Johnson, there should be no guesswork when anyone can test blood for various biomarkers to figure out if treatments are actually working. Then there's probably the biggest bummer no one in the wellness world wants to talk about, which is that the most popular peptide on the market, NAD, or nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, has been linked to accelerated cancer growth. NAD is a naturally occurring coenzyme found in every cell of the body, essential for turning nutrients into energy and supporting cellular repair. And boosting NAD levels with treatment may help aging cells produce energy more efficiently. There's one type of cell that loves NAD, warns Atria Health Institute's Chief Science and Medical Officer, David W. Dodick, M.D., and that's a cancer cell. Before people start dripping NAD into their system, they really ought to undergo a pretty thorough evaluation to make sure that they're cancer-free and metabolically otherwise healthy. Atria Health Institute is a prevention-focused, membership-based medical practice with locations in New York and Palm Beach, founded by Alan Tisch. Unlike Argento's team, Atria won't send a nurse to your villa with a cooler of stem cells, but it is set to open a chic Los Angeles location in 2026. The Institute charges a one-time $80,000 initiation fee, plus $60,000 per year. That's essentially the price of a few Hermes bags for 24/7 access to a medical team led by Dodik, who spent more than three decades at the Mayo Clinic, where he founded and led several major programs related to neurology. While Atria doesn't offer Hollywood a menu of experimental blood therapies yet, it's non-judgmental and wants to be part of the decision-making process. You want that experimental new longevity treatment your friend told you about? Think again. Dodik tells me about a 60-year-old biohacker who, before becoming a patient, got a plasma exchange treatment, you know, to remove toxins, etc., etc., and had 10 strokes during the procedure. It's exactly the kind of disaster Dodik aims to prevent by providing a highly educated and experienced team of medical professionals from 16 specialties who will do research for members even if they don't offer the treatment. They'll even send doctors to other healthcare facilities around the world to determine where the best treatment options are available. I dispatched one of our medical directors to fly today to look at two different stem cell companies, Dodik muses, one that spun under the Karolinska Institutet in Sweden and one that spun under the University of Miami. So these are both bone marrow-derived mesenchymal stem cells. Meanwhile, it seems like every wellness spa in L.A. offers NAD peptide injections as a casual add-on to an infrared sauna appointment. Do they ever ask about the last time you were screened for cancer? Probably not. And do they offer before and after blood panels to track any changes? Not likely. Apparently, we're all expected to go by vibes. Because excess is the point, the injection routines recommended to celebrities are regimented and daily, especially in the weeks leading up to a red carpet. But how many of these stars are also regularly drawing blood, tracking biomarkers, and checking whether any of it is doing anything at all? All of this may explain the rising popularity of Prenuvo, a premier body scan referred to simply as getting scanned every 6 months, made famous in the last couple of years by Hollywood staples like Gwyneth Paltrow, Kate Hudson, and Cindy Crawford. Prenuvo is a private medical imaging company marketed as an early detection tool for cancer and other serious health conditions. For $3,999, you get a comprehensive whole-body scan, lab testing for critical blood biomarkers, advanced brain health assessment, and an FDA-cleared body composition analysis. Celebrities are as likely today to partner with wellness startups as they were a few years ago to develop their own tequila. Matt Damon, Pedro Pascal, Kevin Hart, and Zac Efron are all investors in Function Health, a personal health service created by functional medicine proponent Mark Hyman, M.D. For $499, or about $42 a month, members get access to one yearly comprehensive assessment with 100-plus lab tests and a mid-year check-in with 60 tests for biomarkers covering heart, hormones, thyroid, immunity, nutrients, cancer signals, autoimmunity, and aging. Almost all are blood biomarkers, with a small subset coming from urine testing. Function Health claims to run five times more lab tests than is typical through primary care and has a 500,000-person wait list with 100,000 active members since its mid-2023 beta launch. In May, Function Health acquired Ezra, a company offering AI-powered full-body MRIs. Furthermore, Whoop, a favorite among the White Lotus cast, launched a blood testing service in September, claiming to have a 350,000-person wait list. Whoop, Prenuvo, and Function Health all use Quest Diagnostics for lab work. Pranuvo's Senior Medical Director of Preventive Medicine, Vikash C. Modi, MD, says he sees a lot of substances come up in Hollywood blood, the most common being hormone replacement therapy, HRT, which he attributes to goals around hair, skin, muscle, and energy. His biggest concern is that people are doing HRT, but getting it from doctors who do no safety checks. Again, more issues with responsible tracking. Next, he sees a lot of NAD, glutathione, BPC-157, and GLP-1. The problem is that if people see low inflammatory markers in their test results, they'll think they have to keep doing it because the blood work looks good. But testing before treatment would be key. Many patients don't disclose any of their treatments due to stigma from lack of evidence-based research. But there's a whole library of therapies Pranuvo patients are shy about disclosing, even if some of them show up with their specialty nurses, who sometimes even speak for them. What I'm saying is we are a suicidal species wrapped in pretty stories, Johnson tells me, condemning the sleep-deprived pursuit of money, status, and power. He feels everyone rationalizes that it's better to push through, make the money, and only then enjoy life on the back end. It surprised me that Johnson was the most strongly opposed to any kind of blood-related treatments, despite everyone seeking his advice on the premise that he's done it all. Then it dawned on me that he has finished the game everyone else in wellness is still playing, and in the end, nothing significantly changed any biomarkers related to aging, though he did mention every IV drip deposits 44,000 microplastics into the blood from the plastic tube. So, is it even worth whatever's in the IV? What he really wants is for people to build lifestyles and social systems around quality sleep, because according to him, it's the most powerful therapy available to anyone on any given day, proven by his biomarkers. He says people will do anything to avoid going to bed on time and compensate for lack of sleep hygiene, even when he tells them his findings. We get it, Brian. We're toxic. You could take my experiment and apply it to planet Earth, he tells me. Earth is our home. We need the biosphere to support us. Replace my body with planet Earth, then measure it with a billion data points. Are its arteries healthy or clogged? Is it full of toxins? We treat Earth the way we treat our own bodies, as if the relationship weren't identical. That's why I keep saying don't just cope, deal with it head on. Otherwise, we're ignoring the most important problem we have. I asked Johnson if he's ever tried psychedelics. He did 30 days of ketamine therapy earlier this year, he says. Ketamine is not a psychedelic, though it can have hallucinogenic effects. It had substantial change on my brain patterns. None of this is what I would expect from someone who has immortalized himself with something called Brian AI. He might still be playing the game, but I decide to ask him one last thing. Is all of this just about however much money equals your placebo for feeling good? That's exactly right, he tells me. It's a psychological soothing mechanism. But the way you wrestle control of your life is high-quality sleep, which gives you willpower and better decision-making. So if people tracked everything they're putting in their blood, they'd find out maybe nothing's changing, or maybe they have cancer now, which would make all of their effort counterproductive. They either come to us because of anxiety, or they're going to leave from us with some level of anxiety, says Modi in regard to Pranuvo scan results. Some patients don't want to know about the things they can't fix. They'd rather not know if something was going to kill them. While, yes, we do all deserve preventative health care, and we do all deserve to have more information about our bodies, there's still something missing in our most elitist approach to wellness. Courage and maturity, says psychologist Sheldon Solomon, who is best known for helping develop terror management therapy. He says it's misguided to manage existential anxieties by trying to extend life indefinitely. That's why the ancient Greeks had immortal gods who always wished to be human, he tells me. They were sitting up there forever, just bored. Just like you would be if you were reading a book that never ends or eating a meal where the courses never stop. Without an ending, the experience loses meaning. While all humans have apprehensions about dying, only the elite have had the means and time to be so anxious about it. And like all good fantasies, it's catching. The thirst spreads quietly, disguised as aspiration, through the screens, the serums, the gym mirrors, the blood bags. What began as a luxury treatment for the fatally rich has become the democratization of death denial. Every injection, every supplement, every filter whispers the same seductive refrain. You don't have to decay. The vampire is no longer a monster. It's an algorithm. Because this isn't just a trend. It's a cultural outbreak. A collective hallucination dressed up as self-care. A nation radiant and terrified, sipping from the same silver chalice, certain that if we just keep drinking, we'll never die. the people's princes. In Hollywood's golden age, studios turned regular men into secular gods, changing their names, hiding their flaws. But now, writes Otessa Moshfegh, the era of the remote matinee idol is over, and the dawn of the almost approachable, appealingly authentic modern actor is in full swing. Meet the new class of leading men with photographs by Theo Winner. There's a scene in the 2006 Martin Scorsese film The Departed that acts as a hinge in the story of modern masculinity on screen. It goes like this. Leonardo DiCaprio plays Billy Costigan, an undercover cop in Boston who has infiltrated the mob. He's skinny but strong, impulsive but elegant, gaunt, tired, and smarter than everyone else. What drives him is not a hamstrung instinct to conquer or do the right thing. For him, it's personal. He is, like many of us, fueled by the fumes of his own trauma. Halfway through the film, he finds himself in over his head, his true identity under threat of total erasure. In search of refuge, he runs in the rain to the home of Madeline Madden, a clinical psychiatrist played by a luminous Vera Farmiga. Billy can't explain who he really is. Instead, his body tells his story. He keeps his distance, tense, lonely, aroused, unmoored. Madeline makes him a cup of tea, then studies him, unnerved. "I have to say, your vulnerability is really freaking me out right now," she says. "Is it real?" Billy pauses for a second, checks himself, then answers, "I think so." DiCaprio delivers the line with quiet surprise. We see that he has been illuminated, and so we trust that we are seeing the true man now. We recognize real vulnerability. It looks just like this. And it drives Billy toward Madeline, his body moving like a slow whip across her kitchen. When they kiss, we nearly die. It's better than a normal kiss, because Billy has been converted into a new cinematic archetype, a guy we can now recognize as the prototype of the evolved male star. Enter the internet boyfriend. The phrase has a wink, but the phenomenon is seriously embedded in our cultural DNA at this point. Today's leading men aren't unreachable idols. They feel like real people, very special people, who hover just half an inch beyond our grasp. They're still fantasy men, yes, but boyfriend-shaped. Accessible, kind, vulnerable, and recognizably human. It's not enough to watch these men working as actors on our screens. We want to know them, how they feel, what makes them tick. We follow their playlist, their breakups, their skincare routines. The internet is the perfect environment for forging parasocial bonds because it traffics in illusions and accessibility. And because of streaming and Instagram and YouTube et al., we get to watch and rewatch our favorite moments from our favorite movies. Let's be honest. When Tom Cruise slid across the floor in socks and a shirt in Risky Business, he wasn't sexy, but the studio sold him as God's gift to women. Maybe we bought it because there were few alternatives. One is reminded of another male sex symbol, Marlon Brando. His voice in A Streetcar Named Desire was nasal and weird, but we still saw him as manly. And so was Cruise, though every part of his image has been calibrated, his shortness minimized in press photos, his unnerving intensity recast as ambition. The approach has shifted now, where the difference between a male star's sculpted pose and his unguarded presence is also the story of how masculinity has become expressive and safe at the same time. Big dick energy doesn't mean dominance, but presence, sincerity, and authenticity. Still, Any performance of authenticity is suspect. And these are, after all, brilliant actors. There's a fine line between the man unashamed of feeling and the one demanding to be comforted. The former seduces, the latter regresses. The true internet boyfriend doesn't want to be mothered. He already has a mother, and he loves her. The evolution from DiCaprio's trembling, I think so, to Paul Mescal's tearful silences and Jeremy Allen White's open wounds maps a profound cultural shift. Is the shift real? Like DiCaprio in The Departed, today's leading men look up from the depths of themselves, humbled, emotional, and beautiful. They answer, I think so. We hope it's real. So we keep watching. This article, along with descriptions of the photos, will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections from the CD Peaceful Christmas, released by Regency Music in Nashville, Tennessee.